For the benefit of the recording, let me repeat what I had said in lecture this morning about what you're going to be allowed to use in your lab quiz, and then let me tell you about the types of questions that you're going to get on your lab quiz. So the resources that you will be allowed to use are your lab textbook, but only in printed form, not electronic, so you can't bring smartphones, tablets, anything else except printed out text. We could have a couple of extra copies on hand so that if you don't have a printed version, you don't have to print it out. It is open notes. It doesn't mean that it's open answer, but the textbooks, you know, I can make an allowance there. You also are going to be allowed to use your own lab books, the ones where you took any of your observations in, and then you can bring whatever written class notes that you have, including this discussion of the scheme that we're just about to have. The lab exam versus the lab report. So I can't remember if I had fully described in this section what you're doing for that qualitative scheme lab report. The lab report's going to be very simplified, where you simply list all the different ions, maybe group them by group. So list the A's, the B1s, B2s, and then the C's. For each ion, list what the observation was that you had for the known sample. So, for example, for lead, at some point that you ended up with a yellow precipitate, so you could mention that precipitate for the known sample, and then mention what the behavior observed was for the unknown sample. The idea being that if you observe the same type of behavior for the unknown as the known, well, then you're guessing you had that particular ion as part of your unknown sample. You don't need to do any more than this. So in other words, you don't have to explain any of the logic behind the separation schemes, whatever logic we might now discuss, because the theory behind it, more of the question of why did we do the steps that we did, that's going to be covered on the lab quiz, and that's what you're going to be allowed to use the notes for, to look for some of these answers. So, of course, if you hadn't looked at any of this material at all, you're going to have trouble in terms of time. Even though you have open notes, if you don't know where this information is in your lab text or your notes, then you're kind of stuck. But switching back to the lab report again, none of that theory has to be on your lab report. So the lab report's just going to be the listing of what your results were for the known samples. And I probably had said this, if I did already go over this in the section, that part of the reason I want this is for my benefit, not so much yours, because then I can see what were the results that you got. So the next time I do this experiment, I'm much more able to say, oh, you got that color, try this. Oh, that didn't work, try this. Because seeing what your results were might help for that. As far as then for the purposes of lab report, then you're going to report what you got for your unknowns. And then, yes, after you turn these things in, I can email everyone out what the identities of the unknown samples were. Since there's not so many samples, I'll just list them all. And then if you know your sample number, you'll be able to determine if you got it correct or not. So, let's go over the separation scheme. And we're going to presume that we have samples that have all possible ions in them. So when we did this for real during the lab, for group A, we assume there are no B or C. For B, that's the only one we had that case. C, the same thing. Here, though, I'm going to describe one large flow chart that goes through the whole sequence. And that's the same approach that we're going to take, same attitude we'll take for the lab quiz. So that means that at the beginning, we potentially have group A, B, C, D, and E cations. But, of course, we never got to D and E. So that's not going to be part of the lab quiz, not part of the discussion. It's going to be A, B, and C that we discuss. What was the very first separation that we did for that lab? HCl. What was the logic behind that? So most cations are soluble in the presence of halides except for three, silver, mercury, and lead. Of course, in real life, we did not test for mercury, so we only had the silver and lead because those are the only ones we had in real life. Those will also be the only ones that end up showing up on the lab exam. But that means we did generate a precipitate if we had group A cations, and then otherwise the supernatant contained whatever B, C, or other ions there might have been around. So if we had the precipitate, it's because we had the possibility of silver and lead 2+, And again, the logic here is that group A ions are insoluble as the chloride. And even though, if you notice on the flow chart, I don't include it. Even though we don't have mercury, I want to at least mention mercury in theory, just this one place, because we did have a discussion about how mercury is a dimer. A dimer means two of the same thing that are stuck together. And so the mercury one dimer is two individual mercury ones combined. So that's where Hg2 comes from. But since each one is plus one charge, that's why it's Hg2+. So there might be some question about the dimer, but it won't be related to this flow chart then. In the flow chart, we now have the two ions precipitated as the chloride. So what's the next separation step? Yes. Boiling water, because it turns out that the two compounds, the silver chloride versus the lead chloride, have different solubilities in hot water, which is one of the small but important topics that we unintentionally skimmed over in lecture when we were talking about KSP and solubility. Turns out that in general, KSP values go up as the temperature goes up as well. So that matches with common experience, particularly for any of you. Have any of you ever made rock candy before? A few of you have. Do any of you know how rock candy is made? Supersaturation, which is where you take water and you add sugar. And then you add sugar. And then you add sugar and sugar. And you keep on adding sugars because you can't believe how much sugar can go into water. But you do this when it's hot, where it can take even more sugar in. Then you carefully cool the solution down and you take a string or something like that that disturbs the solution. When you disturb that solution, then crystallization begins. That kind of cascades, and then you pull out a chunk of rock candy. Point of that example being that sugar was way more soluble in hot water, which is why it then crystallized out as candy when the water cooled back down again. So silver and lead, they have different KSP values, and they change as the temperature goes up, and there changes enough where lead, with the quantity of solute that we had and the amount of water, if it was done just right, the lead ended up being able to dissolve in that hot water, but not the silver. At this step, we're adding hot water. There may still be a precipitate. If there is, that should be the silver, or if it was there, the mercury. And then in the supernatant, if lead was there, it should redissolve and come over. So the logic for this step is, again, that lead chloride is more soluble in hot water than silver chloride. Since it's on the left, let's continue with the silver. At this point, we potentially had mercury and silver. What is the next reagent? Does anybody happen to recall here? I'm kind of hearing NH3, ammonia, yes. Which for mercury, that causes a redox reaction, which we're going to ignore. But for silver, if silver is there, it can then come over in the supernatant, but not as silver ion, as the diamine silver cation. In other words, it forms a transition metal complex. So this is right exactly what we're discussing in lecture right now. Silver ion with chloride present, not soluble. But when the two amines, the two ammonias, attach to silver, it creates a new complex ion that happens to be soluble regardless of whether or not there is a halide around. And so that's why it's able to become soluble, and that's the point of this step. Ag plus becomes soluble with chloride present because it forms a transition metal complex. Now, what would have... Oh, yes, question, sorry. Yes. Is that okay? Okay. So, back over here to the left, just to wrap up the flow chart, if there were still precipitate around, then it's the mercury. But like I said, we're going to ignore that because we didn't have mercury in our samples. Over here, we could potentially... Oh, do you still need it pulled down? Is that okay right there? How about that? So here for silver, we need to positively test to make sure we really do have silver. In case we had something that for whatever bizarre reason dissolved, but wasn't silver itself. And so now what we do is we add nitric acid. And that should make a precipitate because you should have silver chloride. Although if you got no precipitate, so it's just supernatant, that means you got no silver. Why is it that we should get silver again when we add the nitric acid? Well, because the reason that silver became resoluble is because we made a complex. The complex was made up of ammonia. If we react ammonia with an acid, neutralize it, it's not going to be able to stick to the transition metal complex anymore. So this would have to be a case then where that complexation ends up being somewhat reversible. So the amine comes off. We have these bare silver exposed to chlorine again. Chlorine and silver match up and they precipitate out. So the logic in this step is that HCl neutralizes the ammonia, so the silver complex is destroyed. We have just one little part to finish off for the group A ions, and that's the positive identification test for lead. So same situation where with that hot water, we supposedly dissolve something, but we want to make sure we dissolve lead and not just something else random. And so what did we add here? Anybody recall? Potassium iodide, that's right, to make lead iodide, which is a very recognizable yellow salt. So if all we had was a supernatant, there was no lead at that point. If we had a precipitate, it's because we did have lead. Questions about the group A? Yes. Let's see. Right here. Sorry. That was the ammonia. So where he was saying right here where my finger is below silver, I had forgot to write in ammonia. I wrote what happened, but didn't write the reagent. Let's move on to the group B's, then. There are, in fact, two groups within group B. There's a B1 and B2 ions. Let me check. Has everybody done writing, or should I give you a second? Wait a second here. And I am going to pull it down again in a moment if you didn't quite finish. So, how were the B's separated out from the C's? What was the first separation of this part? Yeah.
Well, you're really on top of this lab, aren't you? That's a good thing for your lab quiz. I mean, that's not a bad thing. But yes, we add ammonia because these are ions that are insoluble in slightly basic conditions.
So whatever did not precipitate, that's the C, D, and E. Yet again, we're stopping at C because that's all we did. Then we get a precipitate out. That's the group B ions. And logic is group B ions are insoluble in slightly basic conditions. But we split. We split the group B's by adding hydrogen peroxide under basic conditions. So that caused two things to happen. Either it formed a hydroxide salt, or there was a redox reaction that occurred, and that caused some of these B ions to precipitate out, and it caused others to remain as the supernatant. The things that remained in the supernatant, those were the B2 ions. The things that precipitated out were the B1 ions. What were the B1 ions? Those were, let's see, let me list them here. They're the bismuth, zirconium, manganese, and iron. At this point, we had a precipitate, which we dissolved with HCl. And that's what we had that was called the test solution. Let's go ahead and finish up with these B1s, and then we'll move over to the B2s over there. So the B1s, we had a test solution, which then got split up into, well, I was going to initially say four, but technically it's five different tests. First test is with alizarin red, which the result should be a red precipitate. And that test for the zirconyl ion. The next test was a redox reaction where you reacted with bismuthate. And the reason that we did that redox reaction is because if you could oxidize magnesium, then you could make the permanganate ion, which has a very characteristic kind of wineish, purplish color. Now, as I'm going along, are these matching the observations that you all got? When I said precipitate for the alizarin red, is that what you all got? Yes. Okay. And what about for the manganese test? Did you see that flash of purple? I see some people saying yes. Yes? Maybe you don't have your notes with you.
Okay. Next one is where we use 10. And that was another redox reaction testing for the bismuth ion. And then the last test was split into two. That's where we had thiocyanate, that's SCN minus, which if you're reading over the transition metal complex chapter, thiocyanate is a common ligand, which we'll come to on Wednesday. So there's thiocyanate, and then we also had ferrocyanate, which is a transition metal complex. Both of those test for iron. In the first case, it's making just a simple iron thiocyanate complex. And that was sort of a red-brown precipitate that you should have gotten. This other test, yes, it's an iron test, but it makes what is referred to as Prussian blue.
It's this particular dye has a very characteristic blue color, which many of you did not get. And that's because we were being very cautious. Some might say overly cautious, but I don't think we were overly cautious because we worried about cyanide. So because we were trying to keep the conditions really, really basic, we never maybe got to the point where we were at the right pH to get the proper color of the complex. In my mind, that's okay, because at least we didn't poison ourselves. But point being, this is supposed to be some kind of bluish-greenish color, very pastelish blue. But many of you got something that looked kind of gray instead. And that's okay, that was based on the pH.
But it's supposed to be a light blue precipitate.
Now, I'm not, as you can see, having you memorize any of the reactions that correspond to these, but you need to be able to identify where these reactions are in your lab text, for example. But at least I've given you the summary of the logic. So any questions on these ions? Yes. They're all iron threes. And this complex, that is the reagent that was added, that's ferrocyanide. And so the complex forms an ion, or forms a compound with iron itself. So it's kind of an unusual compound. It's iron is the cation, and iron is a complex is the anion. That's what Prussian blue is. Should we wrap up B2s then?
Okay, so for B2, I can kind of squeeze it in on the page here. There are technically three ions that we were supposed to have, but one of them was tin, and the test reagent for tin involved mercury, so we did not do that test.
So at this point, all we had was aluminum and chromium. I think this morning I might have gotten the procedure mixed up a little bit at this point. Here, this is where you heated up those two precipitates and redissolved them with HCl, is it not? Yes. Okay.
So we heated and redissolved.
This is a notation that you're not used to, but it's something that we do a lot in organic chemistry. The 1 and 2 mean do everything under the conditions shown by whatever's under 1, and then do whatever you have under 2, but separately. So what this would mean is heat it, and then react it with hydrochloric acid. In case you don't remember that triangle sign, if you don't have anything else written on it, then universally that tends to mean heat when we're talking about chemical reactions.
So heat and redissolve. That gives you the next test solution. That next test solution, you did some processing because you were looking for that tin ion. As part of that processing, you added bicarbonate, and because we didn't have the tin, we won't worry about the precipitate. We just still have a precipitate, or sorry, blah, 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 supernatant at this point that might still have the chromium or the aluminum ions, which now that solution you separated into two. One solution you added peroxide to, and that was to try to cause a redox reaction to make the dichromate ion. So you get color from that. The last test for the test solution was to add aluminon, which will bind with aluminum to make a red precipitate. Questions on the B2s? Then let's wrap up with the C's. Let me switch to a separate page. So the group C be treated with oxalate.
So the compounds that did not precipitate, those are group D and E ions.
It is the group C's that did precipitate. And after that precipitate formed, we did another heating and redissolving. In that case, it was to destroy the oxalate and redissolve the cations. There are four cations that we could have had at this point: barium, calcium, strontium, and cobalt. That last one, we were able to separate out at the first step of this group using potassium nitrite, not nitrate. Potassium nitrite causes cobalt nitrate to precipitate out as a yellow precipitate. The supernatant contained the leftover ions, which you precipitated using carbonate.
At this point, we have three of the ions left: barium, calcium, and strontium.
It's a reaction with chromate and acetic acid that separated out one of these ions. So if there was a precipitate formed, which the morning section said it was a white precipitate, is that what you all got as well? Yes? Okay. That precipitate would indicate that the barium ion was formed. Whatever was left over in the supernatant, that was the calcium and the strontium. And here, we did another 1-2 combo. We precipitated the ions as their carbonates. And that was just to make sure that anything else that was there that should not be there is removed at this point. Then you want the ions back to do the tests on, so you redissolved. So you precipitated and redissolved. To ensure only the calcium and strontium are present. From there, the last test is to add sulfate. Which, oh darn, I didn't write the numbers down. If you looked at the KSP values for calcium sulfate versus strontium sulfate, there is a small difference between the two. And so this is the most difficult test, but if you were able to do it carefully, it's essentially a case of selective precipitation. And it turns out that the strontium is less soluble than calcium. With sulfate. Now, for some of these ions, you did flame tests because the results can be difficult to achieve properly. And the flame tests were just a backup piece of evidence to help show which ion you really had in solution. But in terms of the precipitates or the wet chemistry, you could say, this is the full separation scheme. So does anyone have any questions on the scheme?
First thing that you need to know about the final is it is going to be cumulative. So in fact, what I'm going to do is pull up the notes that we have from the beginning of class and just walk through week by week what we had covered. We started out the quarter talking about colligative properties. We had done some review on the first day that wasn't completely directly related to solutions and properties, but these are things that you still need to know about. So in terms of review, we covered electronegativity. And a little bit about Vesper theory. Why? Because we wanted to talk about intermolecular forces. These are these attractions that bring molecules together. Why? Because we talked about phase changes. We talked about how it's a balance between two opposing forces, if you want to call them that. The idea that we have molecules that are constantly wiggling due to their temperature, that's the kinetic energy part of it. And then the fact that molecules, even though they would be pulled apart due to the kinetic energy, they're brought back together by these intermolecular forces. Now, we didn't go over all the different types of intermolecular forces like you might have done back in 1B, But we needed to know this balance between energy and the forces because we wanted to see, well, why does that lead to a change in boiling point? Why does that lead to a change in melting point? Those are the two of the colligative properties that we worried about. In order to get to the colligative properties, though, we had to do a little bit with units of concentration. Principally, we focused on molarity and molality, but maybe in lecture Wednesday, we'll do a brief problem that deals with mass percent or parts per million. They're not much more or any more difficult problems than converting between molarity and molality. It's just I was so focused on molarity and molality before we never did do a problem with these other two units in class, and they are very common units. Mass percent is frequently used in a setting where you need to have some kind of stock solution, a solution that you mix up very frequently, and instead of having to calculate molarity every single time, you can just make directions where you say, add 40 grams of that and 60 grams of that, and you're done. That's where mass percent would come in. So we do need to come back for a brief discussion of that. We talked about electrolytes. Electrolytes being things that dissociate in solution. Why does that matter? Because for colligative properties, it's not the molarity so much that matters, it's the total number of particles in solution. So if you have something like sugar that really doesn't dissociate when it goes into solution, each molecule of sugar counts once, you could say. But if you had something like sodium chloride that for the most part completely dissociates when you put it into solution, then you get two particles out for each sodium chloride. And the number of particles that something breaks into is represented by this ionization factor, I. So we discussed electrolytes and strong versus weak electrolytes because we discussed on how that has an effect on I. Two of the colligative properties we first discussed then were freezing point depression, boiling point elevation. Both of them had a formula that had the form of delta T is equal to K times M times I. K, which would be KB if we're talking about boiling point elevation, or KF if we're talking about freezing point depression. That is something that's specific to the solvent, not the solute. M would be molality. That's why we needed to know those concentration units. And I is that ionization factor that I was just talking about a moment ago. You need to know what causes, from a conceptual level, the freezing point to change, the boiling point to change. Now, the way we had discussed it in class is slightly different than the way it had been discussed in the textbook, particularly for freezing point depression. For freezing point depression, the textbook makes an argument about vapor pressures, which is a classic argument, I've been told, but doesn't make intuitive sense to me. Because if we're talking about solids, yes, a solid could have vapor pressure, but how is that directly related to freezing point depression if we're never in the gas phase? So there may be some complicated explanation that makes sense, but it doesn't make sense to me. So in class, what we had discussed is the fact that if you have a regular solvent that is only turning into solid on its own, those molecules achieve a certain more efficient arrangement that maximizes those intermolecular forces. If you maximize the intermolecular forces, that means that you have a higher melting point. Well, if you interfere with that pattern, where you interfere with the intermolecular forces, well then, if those forces are weaker, it takes less energy to overcome them, and so then that's why the melting point drops. that's the explanation that I would prefer to see for freezing point depression. For boiling point elevation, there, I might have discussed it a little bit differently in class, but the book's explanation I like here because it makes more sense. It talks about entropy. The fact that if you have something dissolved in a solvent, that there's more entropy there already. And the reason that that solvent would want to evaporate is because by evaporating, turning into the gas phase, that's an increase in entropy. But if you've already got disorder in the solution because you've already got the stuff dissolved in it, then there's not as much need for it to evaporate if the only reason it's evaporating is to increase its entropy. So in other words, you have to raise the temperature higher to encourage that solution to evaporate, and that's boiling point elevation. So you need to know the equation. You need to know theoretically what causes the boiling point elevation, freezing point depression as well. One topic that we discussed in lab, but we're not going to come back to this at this point, because we're past where it's going to be useful, is we talked about the stages of reaching equilibrium. We imagine that we start out with a container that had nothing in it, and then magically we transported some water into it. And we talked about how, well, right at that moment, the only thing that's going to happen is that water will evaporate. And eventually, though, that amount of water will build up and start to condense again. Not that it's not important related to equilibrium, but you had equilibrium last quarter. So I'm really needing to ask questions just about this quarter's material, so I'm not going to be asking about that discussion of equilibrium. So there, I mentioned that just in case you're looking back over the lab notes and see that lecture. I see it as well, and what I'm trying to say is that we're not going to worry about it. Now, related to boiling point, we have vapor pressure. And you need to know what the cause of vapor pressure is. And the reason I mention that is because that's probably the first place this in the quarter that we saw a molecular energy distribution diagram, which I'll draw up the very simplified version of it. I'm sure you'll recognize it as soon as I start to draw it. Where I have some line through it and part of that graph is shaded. What are the axes? What does that graph represent? It is the number of molecules, y-axis, that have a certain energy per molecule. I say energy per mole, but it could be energy per mole or molecule. The point is that in any real-life sample, molecules are not all traveling with the same speed, the same energy. And so if you're trying to do any kind of process, evaporation, some chemical reaction, there's a barrier to that process occurring, energetic barrier. You get over that energetic barrier, it happens. So the graph is trying to show you that a certain fraction of molecules might have the energy to evaporate or react or whatever they're going to do. That explains, for example, why water is able to evaporate at room temperature, even though its boiling point is normal boiling point is 100 degrees Celsius. I mention that because besides just needing to know what vapor pressure is, the fact that we have molecular energy distribution, you need to know its relationship to boiling point, which is that boiling occurs when vapor pressure equals external atmospheric pressure. So boiling point changes depending on your environment. Okay, so there's more related to solutions and the colligative properties. There's heat of solution, which is the amount of energy gained or released when you take a solute, throw it into solvent. And there's two different ways that we calculate this because there's two different situations. There's if we have molecular solids, which the point of a molecular solid is these are ones in which the molecules, because we have molecules, are attracted to each other by intermolecular forces. And so when that solid dissociates, When it dissolves, dissolving is when you pull the molecules apart physically. It does not mean it dissociates. So we should know here, dissolve versus dissociate. Dissolve to form a homogeneous mixture. Dissociate to break bonds. Not always when you form a solution do you have to break bonds. So sugar, that's an example of a molecule. It is an actual discrete molecule. You can pull out one molecule of sugar. And when you separate it from other sugar molecules, no kind of chemical process is involved. So when we're trying to determine what kind of heat of solution there's going to be, we worry about the pulling those solvent molecules apart, worry about pulling the solute molecules apart, and then mixing the solute and solvent together. So there are three energy transitions we worry about. Then if we have ionic solids, instead of worrying about solute versus solvent, there's hydration versus lattice energy. Lattice energy is the energy that is necessary to pull a set of ions apart. And so anytime that we form a solution, we have to compare what it would be like to pull those ions apart from the solids versus how much energy is released again from those ions getting surrounded by water. Hydration is always favorable. It's always going to release energy. Lattice energy, it's always going to cost something to pull the ions apart. So whether something is endothermic or exothermic is going to depend on this balance of energy. But, and I'll put a note here, if we're talking about heat of solution, that's when things can become endothermic versus exothermic. But whether something is soluble does not just depend on its enthalpy term. Enthalpy being energy changing, excluding consideration of entropy. So enthalpy is just like heat, essentially. And so you can gain or lose heat, but still have something that would dissolve either way. But if the solution is cooling off as you dissolve something, that's because it's absorbing heat. If it's absorbing heat, that means that if it was an ionic compound, for example, its lattice energy is greater than its hydration energy. Because it takes more energy in than what it's releasing. If it's taking more energy in, that's why the surroundings are getting colder. I'm discussing this because out of all the questions I asked back on this exam, the one that more people got wrong conceptually was which way did the temperature change? In fact, I think that came on a quiz one time. So the system absorbs energy in that example that I'm describing, but because it's absorbing it from the water, that's why it's referred to as an endothermic process, and that's why the water is getting colder. That should not be favorable, except we do have entropy. So if delta H is positive, it's endothermic. It should not be a normal process that would want to occur. But if delta S is big enough, it's still going to occur. So that's all the discussion that we had related to solubility, without even getting to KSP, just talking about in general about solubility. There is one other colligative property that we hardly discussed, but you need to know what little about it that we did discuss, and that's osmotic pressure. Okay. Now, even though it is more of last quarter's material, we do need to know something about equilibrium. And there are three different definitions that I wanted you to know. The three definitions were that there is no difference in the rate of the forward and reverse reactions. That's what equilibrium means, equal weight. Weight in this case referring to the ability to form reactants, the ability to form products. Since they're equal, that means they're forming at the same rates. If they're forming at the same rates, that means you don't see any change in the concentrations of reactants or change in the concentration of the products. About half of you on the exam got that one wrong. It's like, wait, we didn't get asked about that on the exam. Well, indirectly you did. There was a question about why is it that when you're at equilibrium, the voltage is at zero. And half of you said, well, it's because the concentration of reactants equals products, which is nonsense. K is the equilibrium constant, tells you the balance between reactants and products. K almost never equals one. What many of you were confusing that with is Q, which in the standard state, Q is equal to 1. But many of you said at equilibrium, Q equals K equals 1. Well, you can't have the standard state and equilibrium at the same time. They're two different things. So it is at equilibrium that the change in the reactant concentrations is equal to the change in the product concentrations, which is equal to zero. Equilibrium has nothing to do with the concentrations of reactants and products being equal to each other. I'm going to come back to that electrochem question later, but I just mention it because we're talking about equilibrium, and we talked about the three definitions. One of the definitions is not that we have equal concentrations. What the definition is that the change in concentrations is equal to zero, because if you have things forming and being destroyed at the same rate, if the rates are equal, that's why there's no change in concentrations. If there's no change in concentrations, then the definition of a state function is one in which its value depends on what the state is, not how you get there. And in chemical reactions, the energy in that solution depends just on what the products and reactants are. So if the products and reactants aren't changing, there's no change in the energy of the system. That was our three definitions of equilibrium. This part we had to know some of because it led to this graph. Reaction progress diagram, which is a representation of the average energy in solution as that solution is forced from 100% reactants to products. That x-axis is not time. It is not reaction coordinate. It's not time because reactions may never get to the end. If equilibrium is the lowest point of the reaction curve, then over time, as time goes to infinity, it's going to stop at K, not 100% products. So the x-axis is not time. The purpose of this graph is to show what is the energy balance if you went from 100% reactants to products. And one of the discussions we had is that in order to have equilibrium, you have to have a little bit of reactants and a little bit of products. Because you can't have a forward reaction if you don't have reactants, and you can't have a reverse reaction if you don't have products. And so that means even for a process like this, where the overall process has, it's exergonic. It's going to release energy overall. Still, from the product side, it would go backwards if we only had 100% products. And that's because there's the point of equilibrium that's just a little bit below either reactants or products. Of course, this is a graph where delta G is less than zero, so that's a spontaneous process. We didn't talk much about it because this graph we talked about in the context of electrochemical cells. And almost universally, we talked about voltaic cells that are spontaneous cells, which by definitions are ones where delta G is less than zero. But we could have an equivalent graph where delta G is greater than zero. And even then, if the reaction's not very favorable, we could see that equilibrium is not at 100% reactants. So it's still going to react forward a little bit. Then we made the crossover to talking about KSP. One mathematical problem we didn't do a lot of, but it is important to be able to do, that's why I'm warning you about it, is to convert back and forth between solubility, which is normally expressed in terms of grams per milliliter, to go back and forth between that and KSP, which involves molarity. So along with the parts per million and the mass percent, this might be another problem we need to come back on Wednesday. But in case we run out of time, I'm making sure to put it here so that you study that kind of problem. Main reason we talked about KSP because that quantifies how soluble something's going to be. And that allows us easily then to determine whether precipitate's going to form based off the concentrations we can calculate being present in solution. So KSP is the limit of solubility. Anytime Q is greater than K, that means a reverse reaction is going to happen. The big thing here is that solubility reactions are always written. Solid going to ions. Solid going to ions. In fact, I'll put that here. As a concept. If solid going to ions is the forward reaction, and we get Q greater than K, the reverse reaction is ions going to solid, which means precipitation. So if Q is greater than K, that means a precipitate's going to form. Now, what if we have two different things that might precipitate with two different KSP values? Well, then that allows us to play a trick of selective precipitation. Now the fun begins. Buffers. So what is it? What is a buffer's range? What is its capacity? Range is related to Ka. So we had a discussion, a review of weak acids and bases, and we had a review of ice problems. Even though I scared everybody with ice problems, we didn't end up working any. Why? Because for most problems where we're truly dealing with good buffers, then we're allowed to make certain assumptions with what happens in solution to the point where we can always get away with using this thing called the Henderson-Hasselbalch equation. I'll come back to that in a moment. But in that discussion, the Ka value comes up, and the Ka value is what's related to range. let's just address this ice problem discussion we have, because I see that we had quite a bit of it in the notes here. And one thing we discussed is, when can we simplify problems? So without going through the whole discussion again, if you look at an ice problem, we end up often with quadratic expressions, because we end up with x squared and x. But often that comes from the fraction that we have. We're substituting our, you know, when we do the ice table, we come up with what our final concentrations are going to be for all the ions. Then we stuff them back in the K equation and solve. Well, there's certain times where we're allowed to eliminate the variable x in our calculations. And the times we're able to do it is when what real change in concentration occurs, when equilibrium is reestablished, if that change is very minor compared to the concentration of the chemical itself. So instead of dealing it with an ice problem, think of it this way. If I had acetic acid, which is a weak acid, if I had 1 mole of acetic acid here and 1 mole of acetate, its conjugate base here, and I threw them both into solution, in reality, the concentration of neither is going to change very much. But the concentration changes a little bit. Now, let's say that I had 1 mole of this, 1 mole of that, and I threw it into 1 liter of solution. Now, we're talking about roughly 1 molar concentrations. Out of that 1 molar concentration, maybe less than 0.1% will change. So less than 1% of that total original molarity. Well, for most applications, 1% error, that's good enough, so we can just ignore it. So what little shift that occurs when equilibrium is reestablished, we ignore. When we're able to ignore it, that's when we can make the simplification in the ice problem. That's also when we're allowed to use the Henderson-Hasselbalch equation. I never did come back to say exactly what the numerical cutoff point is for that, because it doesn't matter in our case, because we're always going to be dealing with buffer solutions. But to answer this question I put up here, when can simplifications be made? The answer is, the short version, when concentrations change very little as equilibrium is reestablished. What the heck does that mean? Well, what is the Henderson-Hasselbalch equation? Because my handwriting is sometimes poor, many of you have this formula wrong in your notes because you wrote it wrong in the exam. The top is A minus, not H minus. There is no hydride involved in any of these acid-base reactions. But because my A's can look like H's, that's the way that some of you memorized it, which can make it very confusing if you have H minus versus HA. Then which thing do I count right and which thing do I count wrong? So A minus over HA. This can be derived from the KA expression itself. But let me retell the story very briefly again, why this equation only works sometimes. Because the way that you use this equation is, the problem tells you, for example, you have a buffer that's 0.6 molar hypochlorous acid, 0.4 molar hypochlorite. And so you'll put 0.6 in and 0.4 in. But that's not the right numbers, because in reality, they reach equilibrium after you mix them. So the values shift a little bit. But let's say that means you end up with 0.6001. and 0.3999. Well, that's close enough to 0.6 and 0.4. We ignore the difference. And that's why we can use this equation that's really easy to use then. So that's what all this discussion with ice problems was about. When and why and how are we allowed to use the Henderson-Hasselbalch equation? So in terms of buffers, you need to be able to calculate the pH of a buffer, which means calculate the concentration of the acid and its conjugate, stick it in the formula, solve. Same process where you have to stick things in the formula and solve, but instead of pH being the variable you're solving for, what if it was the concentration of the acid or the base? And so that's a similar kind of problem where you're still using the Henderson-Hasselbalch equation. It's just that, again, maybe I give you pKa and A minus an HA and you have to calculate pH. It's no more difficult to solve a problem where I give you the target pH and the acid's identity and then you have to solve for the concentration. You've already done problems like that on past quiz or exam. Same type of problem. You would still need to be able to do. Another related problem, if you already had a buffer and you added HCl or you added sodium hydroxide, we talked very specifically about how to deal mathematically with those kinds of neutralizations. And so you would still need to be able to work one of those problems in which you have neutralization occurring. Then related to buffers are titrations. Now, we already had some questions related to titration on your first lab quiz, so you're not going to get those same types of questions. Just to make sure your instructor doesn't do something silly, let me look at the lab quiz questions. So I'm not going to be asking what the difference between the endpoint and the equivalence point is. The lab-related questions that we had that were on the lab quiz. So I've already asked you there once. It was a lab question. I'm not going to give it to you on the final exam then. But you do need to be able to draw a titration curve. Where you are able to identify the buffer range, if that was corresponding to some kind of buffer system. And then you need to know what the significance is of the half equivalence point. The short version is, at the half equivalence point, if you have equal concentrations of the acid and its conjugate, not equal concentrations of the original acid and base, not equal concentrations of H plus and OH minus, but equal concentrations of an acid and conjugate, then this log portion of the Henderson-Hasselbalch equation becomes zero, and so that the pKa equals pH at that point. That's the significance of the half equivalence point. Well, we'll be log of one, which is zero. Okay. So something plus zero means it's pKa equals pH. Okay. Got a little bit more to go here. Boy, we spent a long time talking about buffers and pKa and pH. I'm putting this 130 up here because January 30, that's where we had a good review of the following questions. What is a buffer? What does a buffer do? Why does a buffer resist pH? How much stronger acid can it resist? And what is the ideal composition of a buffer solution? So all those are answered directly on that date. Then the next big chunk of material that we had was electrochemistry. There, we did have a discussion of oxidation state versus formal charge and balancing redox reactions. And then everything else related to electrochemistry. So the standard electrode. What a regular voltaic cell looks like. The diagram that we've been drawing over and over again with a salt bridge. What the standard reduction potential is. Which we get through the use of half reactions. We can use those standard reduction potentials to identify the stronger oxidizing or reducing agent. That lets us then tell which direction the electron flow is going to go if we don't know it ahead of time. So these are all the types of questions that we were dealing with on the most recent exam. We have the standard cell potentials, but then we have the Nernst equation. To handle situations where we are not at standard conditions. Of course, that means we need to know what the standard state is. In lecture, for everybody's benefit, I'll review that question I was talking about earlier where it involved the standard state and Q and K. And then the last thing we'll do probably on Wednesday again with those units of measure review is we still got to talk just very briefly about electrolytic cells. So then, we're on what we're discussing right now. Transition metal complexes. In reverse order of the topics in the chapter, because it's following the way we're now going through the chapter, we talked about crystal field theory. And d orbital splitting. You know there's going to be a question on the exam and probably the final, related to something about this. This splitting, of course, depends on geometry. So one of the topics in lecture today is stereochemistry. And I say complex geometry. It doesn't mean geometry of complex numbers. It means geometry of the transition metal complexes. There are three geometries that we need to be most familiar with. One of them, octahedral, we've already discussed somewhat. That's the case where we went through rationalizing how the energy levels split. There is tetrahedral also, and then there's also square planar. Those are the other two very common geometries. Stereo, wow, brain's working faster than my hand. Stereochemistry. Stereochemistry is that topic where you're discussing what is the geometric form. The main question we've talked about so far is when you have a right or left-handedness to a molecule. So that's what stereochemistry is, discussing these geometric differences. Molecules that are identical other than how they're arranged in three dimensions in space. So that stereochemistry then is going to lead us to discussion today about ligands. So we're going to talk about these terms, which I've already mentioned, mono versus di versus polydentate. There will be a very small number, but non-zero, a very small number of molecules that you'll need to memorize the structure of, because they're the ones that occur so frequently with these transition metal complexes. So it's not going to be very many, probably one key example of a bidentate ligand or a polydentate. You need to know strong versus weak field ligands. That's related to this discussion of crystal field theory. And then you do need to be able to write out electron configurations for the transition metals themselves. And so we did discuss how when you fill electrons, that's going to be a slightly different order than they come back off in. Most specifically, we add 3D electrons after we add 4S, but we take 4S off before we take off 3D. So you need to know that aspect of electron configuration. We did discuss why copper is an exception, and as part of our review on Wednesday, we'll talk about why chromium is also an exception. So you'll have to know chromium and copper. Those are the two transition metals, the only two you'll have to know that there's an exception. But the reason why there's an exception is related to our discussion of spin states in crystal field theory. So that's what we'll be doing in lecture today. That, unless I've forgotten something major, is the list of topics for the quarter. Yes?
What do you know about concentration cells?
Concentration cells. Oh, yes, that's under here, electrochem. Nothing more than what we've already had on the exam. But yes, you still need to know what a concentration cell is. And no, you can't be mad at her that she remembered it for us, because I would have probably remembered it later on anyways.